This is Robin Farmer for the Writer's Voice for Virginia Voice. And today's guest is Richmonder Susan Hankla, a poet, short story writer, and visual artist. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Robin.
For many years, you worked as a traveling poet in the schools through generous grants from the Virginia Commission on the Arts. You have offered adult writing classes at the VMFA Studio School and the Visual Arts Center, and currently you do so privately. But let's focus on your amazing debut collection of poems, Clinch River, which was published by Groundhog Poetry Press, LLC, a new poetry imprint unique to Virginia. Susan, I found your work to be breathtaking. Earlier this week, someone asked me my favorite book, and I said, well, right now it's a tie. It's a tie between Their Eyes Were Watching God and The Glass Castle. And anyone who has read either one of these books knows that the themes deal with surviving amid a hard scrabble life, right? But these women find beauty and power and art in that poverty, and they rise. Your work reminds me of those books. One reviewer described Clinch River this way. There ought to be some hoopla for Susan Hankla's Clinch River. Her pure Americana, ghosts, abandoned houses, unfinished dreams, and censored lives conjures up Nick Cave and Bobby Gentry. Think Casket Vignette or Nikki Hokey at their finest, maybe collaborating on a Southwestern Virginia version of Our Town, or else it's like Dorothy Allison writing a Southern Gothic Spoon River anthology with Frank Stanford. Hankla can really move mountains and sing. Boy, howdy, can she sing. That's what Richard Peabody wrote, and I couldn't agree more. Describe your creative approach for these poems. Are they true, or are they a blend of fiction and reality?
Well, art is the lie that makes you tell the truth. So I would say that it's a lie, but it's true, if that makes any sense. I think that was Picasso. He also said, leave your ego outside the door, which I tried to do because the poems really deal with a topic, Appalachia, where I lived for some time and saw everything firsthand. I did not want to write a memoir. It's really not, it doesn't suit me so much. There are some elements of memoir. It's been sort of translated into narrative poetry. So there is some magical realism in the book too.
Which is, I love magical realism.
I was shocked to find out that Gabriel Garcia Marquez's book, 100 Years of Solitude, is actually his memoir. So if you can call that a memoir, then we're all set. The more and more I've sat with this book for at least 10 years, which it does take a long time, I just really became involved with the characters, and some of them developed over time just as they would in a novel.
I know you spent some time at the Virginia Center for Creative Arts. Did you work on any of these poems while you were there?
Oh, yes. The first one that got me started with a memory of when I was about 7 or 8 in Richlands, Virginia, where I grew up. I started first grade there. Women would knock on the front door on Saturdays and beg for clothes and baby toys. And I usually answered the door. And we would sort of gather around, put things in a Piggly Wiggly bag. It just, that memory came hurling back. And I thought, I have got to deal with this material, because I hadn't really solidly dealt with it before. I'd almost been avoiding it because it's very painful to write about poverty and pain, people's pain, including my own. So I'm glad I did it.
Can you do us a favor and read a few poems?
Oh, certainly. I'll read this one. It has two characters that reappear in the book a few times. one character whose name is not mentioned in this poem that I'm going to read called Chopping Wood Before School. His name is Junior in the book, and Glenda is throughout the book. She's the only person in the book who ages. I'll read it. Chopping Wood Before School. It's going to be hard to write in cursive from this day on. You have lopped off the tip of your finger, almost more than anyone can handle, seeing that blood on the axe. But no worse than the number two pencil of agony later, when you fail to inscribe your note to Glenda, to say how only her blue glasses with stars see that your boots don't fit. She who laments your accident splits shoe leather for you with her father's knife, then forgets, moves on. But her mercy is snow that covers everything. Such divinity. Her abandoned house takes years to be eaten by kudzu. When you come back from a war, having mastered the trigger, you hack through those vine monsters and move into the charred remains, where the veteran, it will be said, once poked the fire with wooden crutches until he blazed. I like my own cooking, even if it burns, he said.
Boy, that's just so powerful.
Thank you. Actually, that quote, I like my own cooking, even if it burns, was from a woman named Dorothy Johnson, who was at the VCCA, and I'd been there a few times, and she and her husband were in and out cleaning and working in the kitchen, and I just wrote that down in my notebook. I thought it was so funny and sort of interesting. So I collect quotes.
Yeah, we call those overheards.
Mm-hmm.
I do too.
Overheards is right, yeah. So yay, Dorothy.
Want to do another one?
Sure. I like to read this one. A woman who is a fictional character leaves town for the day just so she can write her husband a letter, because she's never done it. Dear husband, I'm writing you this letter because I've left town in order to get away from you so that I can write a letter to you, since you have never received a letter from me, your wife, and I think it is time. My writing to you is not as easy as my system of hanging your clothes. Even though one sentence is penned and closely followed by the next in a line, broken only by punctuation, I don't know what I hang out to dry. I'm leaving behind a clothesline of washed pants. They will be frozen in tomorrow's frost, and you will let them thaw and sun bleach, and maybe the birds will find your pockets, as I did. Every pie baked, I dropped, but you ate of them. You drank from the chipped glass, shard in your mouth. You have carried me as a soldier carries one photo, in squelching mud and soot and ash, through the slights of a life. That photo doesn't change. But how does time get by with running away so recklessly? After you read this, sit by the creek and watch small wingings rise where they must go.
Very nice.
Thank you.
And one more.
I think I'll read this one because it's toward the end of the book. It's about Glenda. It's sort of a revenge justice poem. Errata. The box of school paper she saved just to see her mother's name on each report card, so freshly written as if the years have not passed. Then Glenda spies an old math test, and for fun she does the problem over and finds the teacher's error. Then her erasure becomes a black hole to view time through, to see herself parched and nearsighted in the back row. People in those last seats never did well. The boy who missed 100 days for hunting deer, the pregnant girl who drowned in the clinch, eloping. Others in flip-flops who went without real shoes, and herself in altered dresses. But Math, like Branchwater, asked nothing of her. Math, odorless, colorless, like water in the fountains in the hall, where she bent down, cupping it to her lips, drinking from that stream. Nothing but these numbers in memory now. She counts all her surrenders to poverty's fate, one score finally settled at this late date.
Very nice.
Thanks.
Journalist Cynthia Rose said that you understand both the very oldest and the very oddest aspects of Southern redemption. What do you think about that?
Well, I was really flattered that she said that. She and I traveled around together at one point because she wanted to watch me teach children in the Poets in the Schools program. And I think that opened up her eyes to something that the kids had to offer in Appalachia. So Southern redemption is an everyday affair, and I really think that the South is still wounded by the Civil War in many ways, and probably will always be that way, unfortunately, just as the Depression is a factor still and forevermore. I think writing is a redemptive act. I think it's important to use material that you care the most about. And if you're going to write a sentence, make it an interesting one. So I tell my students, don't waste anything. Just if you're going to draw a picture, it better be interesting. But redemption is written about a lot, like Flannery O'Connor, short stories, and Eudora Welty. They come to mind as sort of influences, not necessarily for poetry, but just for matters of the heart. I hope that if people are reading these, they're feeling maybe released from something old and horrible. Because I think my characters are a bit haunted in this book, unfortunately. But for us, we can watch them kind of go through the book and follow their trail.
So in a sense, the ghost can help free people who are haunted by similar pain or stories.
I think so. I like to have a little truck with the ghosts.
You're a graduate of Hollins University, and you also have an MFA in creative writing from Brown University. But I suspect long before then, you knew writing helped you make sense of the world. Do you remember how old you were when you wrote your first poem?
Well, I got a poem published in the Daily Progress, which was the Richlands, Virginia newspaper. It was awful, though. It wasn't the first thing I wrote. But I think the first thing I really got energetically involved with was making up books and then writing fake book reports in fourth grade, and getting away with it was the most exciting part of the whole enterprise.
Oh, that's hysterical.
You have to have a life in crime to be a writer.
Oh, that's funny.
I saw my mother reading books. She ate books. I mean, she just read so many books. And I would watch her write her six sisters, and she would write every week. Even before I could write, I just scribbled on some of her stationery. So then it grew into writing, real writing. So I don't know. I guess I've always sort of been involved in writing one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And certainly reading, because writing is definitely a result of having read.
Right.
And not the other way around, I don't think.
Which writers, authors, poets, who influenced you the most?
Well, we were talking about this at a reading the other day, and my mother had all these books, and I grabbed up the, I think it's American Collection of Poetry, that was her a book club selection that she had, and I opened it to Wallace Stevens, who is really over everybody's head in a way, but extremely visual, and it was The Dominion of 10 O'Clock, or a poem like that, I was really young. I mean, I must have been like 8. And it starts out, the houses are haunted by white nightgowns. I'm like, already I'm hooked. I don't know what it means. And I'm like, I want this. I want more of this. So that just gathered my energy into it.
8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So now talk about the writing community here and how it helped you as a writer.
Well, the writing community here is firmly established and growing all the time. I think that teaching has been a real way to enter into it. And I don't know, I think I'm maybe more inspired by my students than they may be of me, although they say that they love my assignments and I love making them. I don't know, before that, I was just kind of casting about because I was a little bit new to Richmond. So there were things in the community that drew me out, and I did start a reading series at 1708 Gallery in the 80s, which was well attended each month. And I picked the writers, and sometimes they stayed at my house, which was kind of neat. So that started something. Even though I'm kind of a nervous wreck, I like to spearhead things. I interviewed Dave Smith, who was at VCU at the time, as the head honcho of writing, of creative writing, and everybody's going back for MFAs, but I already had mine from Brown, and have always had some kind of investment in writing here in Richmond, and I think the community is wonderful for it. Of course, it's loaded with history, but even I tried to ignore the Civil War history for a long time, as I said before, because it's so complex. But I think having written Clinch River linked me to it in a funny way, because some of my characters, they're not from the Civil War, but they're influenced by it, and they're from Vietnam. In my mind, it's not real clear totally. I don't think it needs to be exactly. But they're veterans. And I feel like I'm a veteran of some things myself. I think all writers are. We've seen some things that we wish we could unsee. We've experienced pain and joy. And it comes out in the work.
Tell me a little bit about Groundhog Poetry Press, LLC. How is this imprint unique to Virginia?
Well, it's unique to Virginia because I don't think there's anything like it. And it's just publishing poetry. And there's not a particular house style. It's all different kinds of poetry. And I was solicited to write this book after years of sending it out and rewriting it to suit people's recommendations. So I think eventually I came up with something that it's about as good as it's going to get. And I'm glad it's nailed down. So I don't have to keep rewriting the poems as I probably would. Because somebody once said, it's all a draft until you die. I think that was Ellen Bryant Voigt, the poet.
I have to write that down. It's all a draft until you die. Who said that?
Ellen Bryant Voigt, who is a very intelligent woman poet. Who's remarkable.
I like that.
Yeah, it's a hilarious kind of thing to say.
So, Susan, what's next?
Well, what's next is to continue giving readings. I'm going to be at the Virginia Festival for the book. I'm reading at UVA Bookstore with two other writers. Our topic is called What the Heart Heard. And so I'll be reading from Clinch River then. And then the next month, I'll be part of the Lit Crawl. I'll be curating three other poets, and we'll be at Belmont Library. So some things like that, try to have something going on. And sometime I'll start reading from my new book, but not yet.
Is it a book of poetry?
It is.
Do you have a working title?
I'm not going to give it out yet, because you'd have to read the book to get why it's there, but it's entirely different, and it it's really about my family, which I've never really written about. I was raised by three unmarried aunts, and so they're in the book a lot obliquely because I miss them so much that it's kind of hard to go at it directly.
Do you think you can write about them now that they're no longer here? Did that give you permission?
I guess so. I picked the one I was least connected to talk about all of them. And I think it's because she broke a punch cup. It was a set of 12, and she broke one of them. So there were 11 left. And something about that triggered the idea of who's left. And, of course, nobody's left. My mother died a year ago, and she was 98. She was the last one.
Wow.
And one fact about them that's funny is that my grandparents wanted a bigger house, so they bought the house across the street, but with the stipulation that the woman in it had to stay on in their house until her death. And they did that.
I look forward to reading your next book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for sharing your work and your incredible insights with Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it. I loved it.